Hi, I'm Taryn Winterbrill, host of Bestseller TV on C-Suite Radio. On this show, I sit down with leading business authors to find out what makes their books stand out from the crowd. With thousands of new business books and titles being published each year, we try to make it just a little bit easier for you to decide which ones are worth the read. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is part of the C-Suite Radio Network, turning the volume up on business.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Bestseller TV. I'm Taryn Winterbrill. We're here with Brady Brim DeForest. He is the author of Smaller is Better, Using Small Autonomous Teams to Drive the Future of Enterprise. Brady, great to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Taryn. Pleasure to be here.
Likewise. Got to say off the bat, love your triple initial situation. Like myself, do people call you BBD?
All the time, since I was a kid.
The Bell Biv DeVoe is what kind of I
thought.
That's
even better.
Right, there you go. What struck me right off the bat when I read the title of the book and I dug into it was, oh, this sounds like one of my favorite expressions, less is more. I say that very often, but I never really thought about applying it to enterprise and business.
Absolutely an allied concept. The reality is that the hardest thing to do in life is taking things out, editing.
Yeah.
And that's what the book is all about. It's about removing complexity from your organization.
Yeah, I mean, is that a hard thing to do? I mean, do you fight a lot of people on that? Because I feel like in today's day and age, we live in just everything is so excessive, more, faster, right? You can't get enough. So, I don't know, to me, I love this. It's kind of an old school idea, but do people say, oh, it's kind of antiquated?
Yeah, I think that there's always a moment of doubt when you look at going faster requires you to slow down. That's a counterintuitive concept.
Right.
And the book is really full of these counterintuitive concepts.
Yeah.
But when you start to break them down and think about them at a granular level, and then you add them back up, they do make a lot of sense. But you're right, they're counterintuitive in this day and age when everything is about maximizing everything, you know, attention, time, capacity, people. We want to grow and grow faster, but that's not always the best way to achieve the maximum result.
True. Yeah, sometimes you got to go back to basics. I wanted to ask you, what do you mean by the future of enterprise? Because enterprise refers to a specific type of business. Is this applicable rather to all types of businesses? Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a good question. So enterprise is really a broadly defined word within the scope of this book. Really wrote the book for organizations that sweet spot really 3,000 or more employees, but the concepts are applicable to growth stage businesses. They're applicable to nonprofit organizations, even down to small businesses. You can take the same concepts and apply them in a team of 20 people as you would in a team of 3,000.
Is it also, would you say the book is prescriptive? Is it sort of preventative? If you're not sure exactly how large you're going to be, would that be applicable?
Yeah, it's more of a practical guide, I think, than a prescriptive process or methodology. A lot of what's contained in the book is a set of principles that then have expressions, ways that you can apply those principles in the day-to-day work that you do inside your organization, and really aimed at transformation from the bottom up,
right?
Helping directors, managers, even VPs who are struggling with momentum and velocity of innovation, or struggling with achieving the quality of results that they've been asked to accomplish, giving them the tools to rethink the kind of common dogma about how to get to that outcome, using a framework that leverages cross-functional teams in small sizes, scaling horizontally across an org, as opposed to the traditional path of kind of building, of kingdom building, really large monolithic silos.
So I guess that begs the question, just to play devil's advocate for a moment, what if I'm a hugely successful business, financially, you name it, is there any reason, but we run, you know, large scale teams, is there still a reason to go smaller, become more autonomous, maybe thinking long term? Like, let's say I'm saying, hey, I don't need your help, we're doing just fine, and our teams are as big as ever. Brady.
Yeah, no, it's a very fair question. And I think my response to that, because it's a common refrain from a lot of our stakeholders inside our client organizations,
sure,
you know, is that what got you here won't get you to where you're going. And the world is changing very quickly. The advent of AI and its disruptive forces on the way that knowledge workers produce outcomes for their organizations, the way that we interact with consumers, the way that we sell. Oh, the entire landscape of business is changing.
Right.
And in order to compete in that world, you're going to, as an organization, have to be able to do more quickly. And the answer to that is by decomposing those monoliths, giving your business the ability to place many simultaneous parallel bets, as opposed to doubling down on just a single strategy or perhaps several strategies.
And you said, so this small teams model is suited for the AI revolution?
Absolutely. Yeah, in fact,
how
so? So AI is going to turbocharge the productivity of the individual contributor. Mm. You know, whether that's someone on a finance team or someone in sales or a software engineer or a filmmaker, AI is going to put the power of a scalable set of human brains at the fingertips of the individual. And that means that organizations are suddenly going to be competing not just with other scaled enterprises, they're going to be competing with individuals in their garage in a way that we can't even fathom today.
Right. Just curious, do you have a prediction on that based on your experience?
Yeah, I think we're you know, probably 10 years out from AGI, artificial general intelligence, and I think that turning point is going to unlock a true industrial revolution. It's going to be as profound as the shift from the pre-electric age into the electric age. We are on the cusp of a really transformational event for humanity.
So just to distinguish, so there's AI, and then you said AGI, artificial general intelligence?
Exactly, yep. Yeah,
I'm not so familiar with the difference.
Yeah, no,
am I supposed to be?
Yeah. No, okay. Not at all. Yeah, it's a little bit of inside baseball. So today
okay.
we have generative AI, which you know we're all familiar with, ChatGPT, Sora, you know, AI that's essentially mimicking human behavior and replicating the results, the outcomes that humans can produce, but based on training data. AGI is this moment where AI becomes essentially self-aware and recursively self-improving. That turning point is profound because it means that we'll be interacting with AGI, with AI in a way that's indistinguishable from the way that we interact with other humans. And when you think about what's holding us back as a species, it's not so much that we can't solve the problems that are facing us, it's that we don't have enough human brains to solve them.
Right.
And we're on the cusp of this transformational event where suddenly we will have not just 8 billion brains, we'll have trillions of human brains to point at humanity's most complex challenges.
Does that scare you at all?
I'm personally really excited by it.
Okay.
I think that every step change, every massive technological innovation, from the printing press to the invention of the steam engine to electrification, it has always disrupted everything.
Yeah.
But generally, I think if you look at the trend of history, humanity is incredibly adaptable.
Mm-hmm.
And we've become insanely more productive over time. So what the individual worker can produce today versus 100 years ago or 500 years ago is massive step changes apart.
Right.
And AI is going to provide that same kind of acceleration.
C-suite radio.
Net, I think it's going to be positive. I think there will be different jobs, different opportunities. It's going to, in my opinion, flip the pyramid upside down. Gatekeepers that exist today will no longer be as relevant because the power will be in the hands of the individual to do to compete on the same scale as the enterprise.
Right. Well, my instinct, based on everything you just said, would be smaller would be better, right?
Absolutely.
If efficiency is scaling down, everything's smaller is definitely going to be better when it comes to team size. So let's specifically get into that, because we talked about what the size of enterprise was. You said about 3,000 employees, but when you define small team, is that about 5 to 8 people?
Spot on. That's
okay.
Exactly right. And if you look at the science, every time you add an individual node to a team, so if you go from 5 to 6 to 7 to 8,
right,
each one of those additions increases the complexity by a significant factor because of the way human relations work, communications overhead. You add an extra node to the graph, and now, when you're going from 5 to 6, you've increased the complexity of the unit economics of that group.
Yeah.
By a significant factor of complexity. And as you scale teams, the overhead required to manage them, to communicate inside those teams, becomes increasingly burdensome for the team and its ability to move fast.
So even, Brady, let's say a 9-person team is going to make a huge difference compared to 8 based on your research?
Yeah, a 9-person team will have a lot more overhead required to operate.
Right, right.
Every problem has a different reality, though, and so there isn't a specific team size that's suited to any particular problem. You really have to analyze critically what the core functions you need on that team are. So one of the principles in the book is about building teams with cross-functional capabilities.
Right.
So in many cases today, when you think about building a team to accomplish a mission inside of most organizations, the work is isolated to just one layer or one altitude. What you really need is to take and pull in the functions across the enterprise: legal, marketing, sales, product, engineering, and embed them in a single group with a single mission that's autonomous and able to cross the penny gap. They have to be able to take the product or the service that they're developing or building or the problem they're solving. They have to actually be able to take it all the way to market. And that's such a critical distinction.
Yeah.
In most organizations, there are 3,000 gatekeepers between the team and the customer.
Yeah.
Collapsing that space, putting that team in direct proximity to the end customer is so critical.
Right. Can you tell us about any real-world examples, Brady, of maybe large organizations that have now become more autonomous and use the smaller is better concept to their success?
Absolutely. So I won't pick on too many of my clients, but I will share a couple of really great references. AT&T is a really good example. About 10 years ago, they adopted the small team model inside of their innovation foundries. The acceleration they were able to achieve, reducing their time to market for a greenfield product, which on average took about 36 months, was compressed all the way down to a sub 12-month timeline. And that's truly from point of ideation all the way to general commercial release. That's a massive
you said
shift.
36 months to less than a year.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. and you see that kind of impact throughout enterprises that adopt this model. I think the real upside is difficult to see as you embrace this process, because as I said, you often have to slow down to speed up.
Yep.
But the compounding effect of the transformation starts to pick up as you scale this model across a horizontal swath of the organization. So if you just do it in one place, you're probably not going to see the kind of outsized results you want. But if you take the model and you apply it across.
Scale it.
Yep, exactly.
Right.
And you decompose these large complex problems and into bite-sized chunks.
Yeah, I love that. Snack size.
Exactly.
I always like that. Did I read as well Berkshire Hathaway operates in a similar fashion?
Yeah. So if you look at the way Berkshire is structured, their central team that oversees Warren Buffett's empire is really small. And that's a great example where even inside of a super large monolithic organization, the unit of value production, the teams who are making the decisions around where to invest and how to delegate authority is really small.
Right.
So you can think of an organization like that as having a symbiotic relationship with its constituent parts, but each one is essentially self-contained, has autonomy to operate, to drive and achieve results. Where things start to break down is when you try to integrate everything into a central, more autocratic, if you will, structure with top-down micromanagement. That's where things break down inside of large organizations.
Okay. So let's just pull back for a second for someone not familiar with the way maybe a business works. So you come in, are you trying to take away just large leadership teams that are making all the decisions, right? Like where a decision is just at one kind of mission control area and we're saying, hey, now we're going to make little teams and then everybody kind of the sum is greater than the part of the whole. Is that kind of on a broad level how this works?
You're spot on and you're honing in on a really critical concept, which is pushing autonomy to the edge. So in organizations where decision making is typically done in the center, you see a lot less effective decisions being made because the proximity to reality there's a distance, there's a gap. So organizations that adopt this model tend to see significant improvements in the quality of decision making because they're enabling, they're empowering teams that are sitting in the middle of those challenges to make the day-to-day decision making. Decision making is an art rather than a science.
Yeah.
And none of us can accurately predict the quality of the decisions that we make.
Yeah.
What's critical is the speed of decision making.
Right.
So anything you do to increase, to accelerate the speed of decision making means that you're able to make smaller, faster decisions, which means that you're able to fail quicker. And that's the critical part of achieving success. Maybe counterintuitively, you need to fail really quickly in digestible chunks, and you need to do it as fast as you possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
Because the difference between ultimate success and failure is, you know, you fall down 10 times, the 11th time you stand up, right?
Yeah.
But you have to continue to fail and until you achieve success. Very few of us as humans are good at learning from our success.
Yeah.
We ultimately learn from failure.
Right.
The trial and error process. And organizations are just collections of humans.
Right.
And so they work the exact same way.
C-Suite Radio.
And speaking of learning, just tell us a little bit about your background, just the research that went into this, because it's very technical, it's very specific. So how did you gather all of this?
So most of the book is based on, you know, practical real-world experience consulting for the Fortune 1000. It also sits on the back of giants, those that came before, the experts in organizational transformation and design, the business leaders who have, by trial and error, figured these concepts out and how to apply them. So the book is an amalgamation of wisdom that I've been exposed to and collected and experienced firsthand over the course of my career.
Yeah, and it was something that caught me. The first chapter, I was curious how you came up with this. It was funny, I chuckled. It's entitled, Yes, Yes, Change Everything.
Absolutely.
I was like, okay. Tell us about the genesis of that title.
Yeah. I think in my experience, the idea that in an organization that anything is written in stone is wrong. But there's still this organizational pushback in most companies to accepting the reality that we can rewrite any of the rules. I think Steve Jobs, said it well. If you're not happy with the world, then change it.
Yeah.
Something like that. I'm paraphrasing.
Yeah.
But similarly, in organizations, our society at large, this is certainly true as well. All of the rules were created by us.
Yeah.
And I think it is critical to look around at your organization and begin with the premise that anything can be changed and should be. And most likely, in order to get to where you're going, you're going to have to change most of it.
Yeah. And it all boils down to, and you talk about this in the book, you talk about how imperative it is to move leadership out of the way. Again, sounds counterintuitive, but it's actually the opposite when you describe it in the book and how it actually is so effective.
Yeah, I think in many cases, leaders forget that their job isn't to be in charge. Their job is to support the teams around them to deliver, to achieve the results that they're delegating to them. Leadership ends up being the bottom of an inverted pyramid. The most important people in the organization are those on the front lines, those that are working with clients and customers. Leadership is there to ensure that they have the environment to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
And great leaders regularly create that environment, and that is the recipe for their success. They create organizations where they are unnecessary.
Yeah. You talk a lot about radical transparency being crucial for success. How so?
So,
especially, in an organization that large, it seems, again, counterintuitive.
Yeah, I think most of us are scared of transparency because it's not the most comfortable thing. And when you think about, transparency of compensation, transparency around financial performance, the common concept is that we should silo that information and it should be exposed on a need-to-know basis. But when you look at the way that the organization improves, when you put the truth into the hands of the people who are driving your business forward, the outcome, the step change effects that it has is just incredible. Organizations that embrace radical transparency are able to deliver outsized results compared to the competition. And I think it really comes down to they're starting with the premise that everyone in the organization can make better decisions when they have accurate information on which to base them.
And it comes down to trust.
Absolutely.
That's what it is. Any real life examples, Brady, of a company that was not radically transparent, they employ it and boom, things completely change for the better?
Yeah. I'll use our organization as an example just because I know the transition firsthand. When we first implemented radical transparency inside the four walls of our firm, the result was really shocking. Within 12 months, we had tripled in top line revenue.
Wow.
And I attribute most of that improvement to a world in which suddenly everyone was speaking truth to power, where we were no longer hedging our bets, pulling our punches. We were putting the truth on the table, and we were using first principles reasoning to address it. The benefit of radical transparency ultimately is that it enables us to look at the same set of data, to drill down into the actual causation, not just the correlation, and make principled decisions from the bottom up.
Do you see, just in your experience as your business guy, do you see so many businesses just doing it so incorrectly, where you say, like, there's just such a simple fix here? Do you see that all the time?
All the time. That's the thing about the book and the way that we work with our clients. The changes are really simple to make. They're not complex. They don't require an army of MBAs.
Yeah.
They require a commitment to being good stewards of the process, and they also require a commitment to investing in the people around you.
Exactly.
And I think in most organizations that we come across that are struggling with the cultural challenges that come with scale, they've defaulted to behavior that results in tribalism, results in silos of information, and ultimately creates a tremendous amount of internal competition that doesn't actually help to move them forward.
Yeah.
You've got to be focused outside. Inside, you should start with assuming positive intent. You should start with alignment around measurable objectives and missions that actually align internal efforts. But so many organizations have lost the sense of shared mission.
Mm-hmm.
And the lack of transparency, the lack of real-time feedback really impact their ability to succeed.
So just final thought. So who is this book written for? If I'm someone out there watching, how do I know that I need to pick up this book?
So if you're someone who's working in an organization that is struggling to achieve its results, struggling to out-innovate the competition, struggling to define new markets or take advantage of new opportunities, this book likely has advice that will be helpful to you. If you find yourself waking up in a cold sweat at night because you know you're going to miss your targets, you know that you're going to have a disappointing conversation with your leadership team about why your team hasn't stayed on budget or hasn't accomplished its goals for the quarter, then this book has something in it for you.
Yeah, and I'll just add to that and say it's a pretty simple mechanism. You know, you write it out, very logically, and it's easy to understand and digest. So, bravo. Will there be another book? Smaller is better.
Good question.
Smaller.
I thought about maybe writing bigger is better next.
Right. Yeah. Or something.
But no, there is another book coming, and I'm already about 3/4 of the way through. So once you write your first book, the second book is that much easier.
I was wondering if the next book might be titled Tiny is Even Better. Maybe.
I'll take that under advisement, Tara.
All right. Thanks for being here, Brady.
Thanks so much for having me.
If you'd like more information on the book, just check out our website. It's csuitebookclub.com. That's csuitebookclub.com. I'm Taryn Winterbrill. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time right here on Bestseller TV.
Like what you just heard, visit c-suiteradio.com. C-Suite Radio, turning the volume up on business. This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.